Good morning. Welcome to Your Health. I'm Ann Goldin, and today I am talking with Dr. Chris Centeno. He is an MD and an international expert and specialist in regenerative medicine and the clinical use of mesenchymal stem cells in orthopedics. Good morning, Dr. Centeno.
Morning, Ann. Thanks for having me on.
Oh, yes. It's a pleasure to have you. Okay, so let's talk about some of the different joints that you've worked on and some of the different kinds of injuries and people that you've helped. If you can think of someone that, you know, jumps out, that's really quite a remarkable story.
Yeah, we have a number. Probably a good one would be Jarvis Green. Jarvis is an NFL player who used to play for the Broncos. Like many football players, he got a knee injury with some damage in the cartilage under his kneecap. As a result of that, he was unable to go back. He ultimately had some microfracture surgery that didn't really work, so they cut him from the team, and his career was really at an end. He came to us. We were able to treat him with his own cultured and same-day stem cells underneath the kneecap. He also had a loose ACL. We were able to do some injections into that to tighten it up. And then as a result of all that,
were stem cells?
Correct.
Okay, yes. Go ahead.
And as a result of all that, he was able to get picked up again by a Texas team and is now playing in the NFL again. So he's a good one that jumps out, and then there are obviously others, but that's one that jumps out.
So that's exciting. So really, his professional career would have been over if it hadn't been for stem cells.
Correct.
Because all the traditional stuff had been done.
It had been done, and obviously a knee replacement is not practical in someone playing at that high level.
Well, he would definitely never play with a knee replacement.
That's true. I've never heard of that happening.
Yeah. Joint replacement doesn't put you back at that same level. Although, my mother, after hip replacement, was out playing competitive tennis again, but...
Oh, okay, good.
But she was motivated. But of course, somebody at a professional level is motivated to do whatever it takes. So, you're doing a lot of different joints now. When I first heard you talk about it, all I heard about was hip. And a lot of people that I see have hip problems and are told that they should have their hips replaced at some point when they can't stand it. That's kind of the mantra that we hear.
Right.
You've been doing a lot of stem cell work replacing on hips?
Yeah, we do. We've done hips and knees since the beginning and have branched out into shoulders and other joints. Hips are interesting in that we tend to get them a little bit farther advanced than we see our knee patients. And we've actually had to develop some new tools to be able to place the cells where we want them inside the hip. But the hip data looks very promising. As long as the patient doesn't have avascular necrosis, which is common in hips, that's where the bone starts to die off. We're getting equally good results in hips now as we do in knees.
Okay, so let's talk about what those results are. What happened? I mean, I come in and I'm limping and I can barely walk and it hurts every step. And I've been told I have bone on bone or whatever. Very little joint left.
Yeah, so for a cultured procedure, we would probably keep you in the good candidacy range, meaning that the severity of your hip doesn't seem to impact how well the procedure works for cultured. For a same-day procedure, if you're bone on bone, you'd probably be more in the poor to fair candidacy range.
Mm-hmm.
We would take the cells out, either culture them or not, put them back in using some special techniques. In hips, in total, if you look at everybody, meaning the folks that didn't work in versus the folks who it worked fantastically in, there's about an average 60-some percent reduction in pain and increase in function, meaning that's what patients are reporting to us at 1 to 2 years after the procedure. Most of that would start probably 1 to 2 months after the procedure. But we looked at it at 1 to 2 years just to try to get a better slice of what the duration of effect was.
Right. And now what about, could you improve those statistics by doing another injection?
You know, it's certainly possible. You know, in that particular study, we were a little limited in that. We generally, for hips, only did one or two. But yeah, that's certainly possible. I think what we find with this, like any procedure, is that you have people who respond really well, who report 90, 100% relief, 80% relief. And we also find some patients who tend to have more stem cell-related problems for other reasons. They're not as active as their, you know, the guy down the street, or they're, you know, they tend to have more medical problems and hence are on more prescription medications. So we've definitely seen trends in our data that would suggest that there are some patients, i.e. those who are a little bit more active, not on prescription medications, otherwise healthy, whose stem cells seem to work better than patients who are on a lot of prescription medications and have health problems.
That's an interesting thought, that your stem cells will be healthier if you're healthier.
Yeah, and what's really fascinating to us, I'll give you an example, is the effect of some medications. It's really a little disturbing to see that some prescription medications that seem to be branded safe seem to negatively affect your stem cells, meaning that we've had now multiple times where we cultured cells. We had patients on certain prescription medications. The culture wasn't going well. We then brought them back in, took them off those medications, brought them back in for a second culture run, reharvested the cells, and the cells grew fine.
Whoa, so what medications are adversely affecting stem cells? That sounds like it would affect your ability to heal with, you know, and just in general.
Yeah, a very big one, interestingly enough, was lisinopril. Lisinopril,
oh God, great,
is a ACE inhibitor blood pressure medication. We started to see a lot of it because it went to generic about 5 years ago. And so all of a sudden we saw this massive increase in the number of patients walking in on lisinopril that was generic. And it seemed to be a big one. Another one, interestingly enough, and we're not sure if this is a medication effect or related to having high triglycerides, because we can run the numbers both ways, are actually statins. So statin drugs, very common cholesterol drugs, seem to have an impact on cells. Now, that also could be high triglycerides, because we've also seen that, that if someone has high triglycerides, their cells don't seem to grow as well in culture. So we're not quite sure on that. But those are two examples of things we would see a lot.
Wow. Well, those are drugs that, you know, like, I don't know, 1 out of 3 people over 50 is either on one or both of those medications.
It's very true. And that's a little disturbing. I think what we'll see in the future probably is drugs being tested against adult stem cells, because this is a new concept. And, you know, if they do negatively impact adult stem cells, that's probably not good. I mean, these are the things that help to keep you alive. They're the things that maintain your body. Mm-hmm. So if a drug is having a negative impact on that cell population, that's probably something we have to put in the not good box.
Yeah, well, let's talk about that more. What do adult stem cells do in our body normally?
They are the maintenance men. They literally, you know, everyone knows that house, maybe the neighborhood where you grew up, that had maybe some older people living there, and they couldn't take care of it very well, and it got really dilapidated through the years, you know, and might be an older Victorian haunted house or whatever. you know, that's what stem cells do. They are the maintenance men. They're the reason if you go to the gym and you tear up some muscle, that muscle heals and gets bigger. They're the reason if you go for a run or walk around the block and you kill off 1,000 cartilage cells in your knee, that those cartilage cells get replaced. They literally are the maintenance men that keep us up and keep the maintenance up in the body as we age. And as we age, we tend to have less of them or able to call on them less. So it's one of the theories of aging is that stem cell pool starts to get exhausted.
Wow. Okay, so if that's what they do in our bodies, then when you harvest them and put them in a joint, do they change what they do? Or how do they know what to do when you take them out and put them back in a different place? You take them out of the marrow and you put them in your hip.
Lots of different clues to the cells. So everything from pressure. So for instance, if a mesenchymal stem cell, the kind we're talking about, gets into an ultra high pressure environment, it would tend more towards bone. If it gets into an environment that's less pressure, it might turn into cartilage. If it gets into an environment with a stretching type pressure, it might tend more towards muscle or tendon. And then there are local clues, i.e., what's the identity of the cell next to me? And then there are also microenvironment clues. There are things in the local environment that can help them. So, for instance, I'll give you a great example. You go ahead and fracture a bone. The bone marrow stem cells leak out, and they clot into the fracture. And then the first thing that happens is they start looking around and seeing what cells are next to them. So they get some sense that they need to be a bone cell. And then they start sensing the chemical environment. And in that case, there's calcium and other things that they would look at to become bone cells. And then eventually, as you start to load the area, the pressure on them also pushes them in that direction of being a bone cell, meaning that those cells are getting, far, far more pressure on them on a day-to-day basis than, for instance, the surrounding muscle cell. So those are all an example of just three of the things that cells look at. And this happens all the time in our bodies. So the nice part about adult stem cells is they know from your body exactly what to do and what to be, because that's literally what they do every day. There isn't a part of your body, it seems like, that doesn't have stem cells resident in it. Everything from your teeth to your gums to your muscles to your joints to your bones.
So obviously we would die if we didn't have them.
Yeah, I think if you lost all of your stem cells, you wouldn't last long.
Yeah. So this is a procedure, injecting them to move them around to where you need them to make a newly refurbished joint.
Correct. That's the general concept, is to take them from one spot and put them in another. And surgery has done that for centuries, meaning that, it's been common in surgeries, for instance, to take veins from the leg and place them into the heart and have them be arteries. Well, how do they become arteries in the heart? As soon as the pressure starts pounding through them, they change. The body knows through the stem cells in those veins that now they've got to take on a different function, and so those veins take on the properties of arteries. So we've really relied on many of these things in surgery for years. We just didn't know at the time what it was that made them that way.
And so I guess the same thing when somebody takes a little fleck of bone out of the hip and puts it across where a fusion is trying to happen. Then the bridge of all those stem cells come in and fill in all the gaps and make it all bone.
Same thing. And in that case, the key would be exposing the inside part of the bone, because again, that's that chemical clue of exposing the calcium, for instance, within that bone. But literally lots of different things that happen in our bodies. And braces are a good example. You put braces on somebody and you see remodeling in the bone where the teeth are anchored such that the teeth start to take on different positions. That's all being accomplished through stem cells.
That's amazing. Let's take a break. When we come back, we'll talk more. You're listening to Your Health. I'm Ann Goldin, and I'm with Dr. Chris Centeno. If you just tuned in, you're listening to Your Health. I'm Ann Goldin, and I'm with Dr. Chris Centeno. He is a medical doctor. He's an international expert and specialist in regenerative medicine and the clinical use of mesenchymal stem cells in orthopedics. Do you think that that you could take stem cells and harvest them and grow them and put them in a pancreas or a liver and regenerate those tissues?
Yeah, there's actually been a good amount of research, both in animals and in early clinical trials, on taking bone marrow stem cells that are cultured and using them in type 2 diabetics in a pancreas. So they're usually delivered either via direct injection into the pancreas or via the artery that feeds the pancreas through a interventional radiology approach. And there's been some really nice data presented at some of the conferences that I attend showing blood glucose tolerance improving, things like long-term measures of blood sugar levels like HbA1c improving. So yes, I think that is completely feasible, and I think that we'll likely see over the next 5 years those kinds of treatments becoming more popular, especially in type 2 diabetics. Now, type 1, you know, the younger onset, more severe diabetes may be a little bit more difficult because it requires almost growing a new pancreas. But in the type 2, where it's more a burnt-out pancreatic cell, that seems to be very promising right now.
Well, wait a minute. I think of this as regenerating the organ, so why not get a new pancreas?
Well, I think it's doable. I think what would have to happen there, what we'll probably see for new organs is a little bit of a different approach, probably a bioprinting approach. So, for instance, right now there are many researchers that have literally taken inkjet printers, the kind you have at home, and they fill each cartridge rather than with ink. They fill one with cells, one with a matrix, maybe one with another kind of cell and another kind of cell. And they literally place the cells and all the biomatrices to print out an entire organ. Because if you think about an organ, if you're going to start one from scratch, you have to have all the cells in the right spot. And there might be 5 or 6 or 7 or 8, 9 or 10 different types of cells that make up an organ. So I think for brand new organs, I think you might be able to get some repair in type 1 diabetes, but for type 1 diabetes, it may be at some point reprinting a pancreas and placing that back in.
In that reprinting, do you actually have an organ in? It grows? You actually get a chunk of tissue that you would implant?
Yeah, they just did this with a trachea. So yes, you do get something that looks like the real McCoy.
Wow. So then we should be able to do that with a liver or a heart?
Should be able to do it with all of those things. And yeah. I think that there's a lot of progress being made right now in that direction. So again, I could certainly see a time 20 years from now where it was very uncommon to have an organ donation because you can print new organs at will.
It's so cool. I mean, it's so neat to have people like you at the forefront of this whole regenerative industry that's going to change healthcare and improve our health. I mean, I'm excited that I'm at the age where I'm still in really good shape, but I know that this stuff will be there and more developed when I need it.
It is. And it's, you know, in many ways, what's really fascinating about it is that, you know, a lot of what doctors do today is really manage chronic disease. You know, there isn't a lot of fixing going on.
Right.
And I think for the first time, this field will open up the ability to fix some things. And, you know, with that obviously comes dramatic changes, you know, far fewer medications being prescribed, people obviously living much longer.
In a nursing home, longer in a productive life.
In a healthy life.
Right.
And also the table slanting from right now, we really wait until something is totally destroyed, like a joint, before we consider putting a prosthesis in. You know, that table will slant in the direction of trying to catch problems early and prevent their occurrence because we know we can, rather than waiting till something just blows up.
That's a good point. You know, people ask me all the time, is running good for my knees? Is running bad for my hips? Should I do it? Should I not do it? I'm going to ask you.
I think that there's now some information out there that shows that in normal, healthy people, running can be cartilage protective. But I think here's the problem. As you see studies all over the map, and I think The reason you see studies all over the map is that if you have, let's say from early on, a big hole in the cartilage that happened when you were younger, and you run on that, it can go the opposite direction of getting much worse. If you have sort of normal, healthy cartilage, then I think running on that cartilage is just fine. It may actually protect the cartilage. The other nice part about that is that there's also now research showing that if you develop a metabolic syndrome, which is sort of the triad of being overweight, high blood pressure, high triglycerides, that in of itself, forgetting about the effects of just the extra weight mechanically on the joint, can chew up cartilage. So just having the abnormal blood sugar associated with a metabolic syndrome can itself start to chew up the cartilage.
Well, there's another motivator for people. So what do you think about running on like concrete and asphalt versus running on trails or a track that's, you know, made out of tires that's a little softer? Do you think that makes a difference? Or at the beach in the sand?
Yeah, I would say that if you're going to run, stay as close to what our ancestors did as possible. We're probably tuned to run on the ground, probably not on asphalt.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, we haven't talked at all about controversies. I know that we talked once and you were complaining about the FDA bugging you what you could do in your lab. Are politics hindering your work?
Well, it certainly made it more difficult. For instance, the FDA currently claims that if you culture a patient's cell to get more, then for some reason, even though they're the patient's cells, they become a prescription drug.
Oh, give me a break.
Yeah, that's what we said. It didn't really make much sense. It doesn't make any sense using any scientific analysis we can come up with. So we basically just moved our culture lab to the Cayman Islands. We're still in the process of fighting that whole thing. What we do here in Colorado, all the things right up to that point where they don't think it creates a drug. But once we get into needing to culture, we've moved that down outside the country. And it's really sad if you look at that because, you know, we move jobs outside of the U.S. It's more expensive, obviously, to
start a lab. Right, so then it costs patients more. Yeah.
It costs patients more in travel. It costs patients more because we had to build a new lab. And, you know, the innovation then starts to get pushed out of the U.S. into some of these countries that are more interested in trying to bring that innovation into their country.
That's crazy. We're supposed to be the country of innovation and brilliant minds and charging ahead, and here we are. Let's drag and put a weight on your leg and not let you do this.
Yeah, Forbes just had an interesting article. It was out last week on this very issue, how the FDA has been dramatically increasing requirements for new drugs and devices, and how that has driven most companies these days are avoiding the U.S. altogether. So what they'll do, for instance, I know several people that are trying to create biologic drugs, and they have taken it completely outside the United States. They're running all their trials outside the United States. At some point, they'll bring it back in the U.S., but those drugs will be available in Europe and Asia well before they're available in the U.S., and they'll only come back into the U.S. once they have all of the hoops jumped through. So literally, people in Asia and Europe will be getting access to these really great things a good decade before anyone in the U.S. has access to them.
Well, that's crazy. I wonder if anything can be done about the FDA.
Yeah, I don't know the answer to that one. You know, if I did, I'd probably get the Nobel Prize or something.
Oh, yeah. Well, maybe that's part of, you know, I think that answers will probably emerge over the next 5 years. I mean, if you can call your own body tissues a drug, a prescription drug even, that doesn't make any sense.
It's an interesting concept, and it's really unprecedented if you think about it in the history of health regulation. But I think the FDA is presented with an interesting conundrum, and I almost don't blame them from a protectionist standpoint of the direction they took. I don't think the direction they took was reasonable from a public health standpoint or reasonable from a patient standpoint. But if you look at this, what's happening in cell medicine is so unique and so disruptive that in 20 to 30 years, there may be very few prescription drugs to regulate. It may be that large sections of the existing prescription drug market just don't exist because we're fixing things for the first time. We're not managing them. So I think what we're seeing is basically an agency that's trying to get its arm around those changes. They know those changes are coming. They're trying to find a way to regulate them, even if it turns out that the drugs happen to be in your own body.
That is amazing. So it's like they're feeling their mortality and they're trying to grasp for what will be our useful function in the future.
I think there's some of that involved. And listen, I like most physicians, you know, before I started this stuff, I really had very little reason to even think about the FDA. They were on my radar screen only as far as they would approve some drugs. You know, every once in a while I'd see the news that said that this drug wasn't safe or that drug wasn't safe. But as a practicing physician, on a day-to-day basis, they just didn't impact my life directly.
Mm-hmm.
Until they started claiming that the cells in my patients' bodies were prescription drugs.
And that's the research you're doing, so it directly impacted you, where probably the rest of us, that didn't have any impact.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And, you know, so it's like anything else. I mean, you don't really pay attention to these things until they impact you.
Right, right. So if people want to get in touch with you, and I'm sure there are people who do, give them the easiest way to do that, whether it's through a website, email, phone, whatever contact information you'd like to give out.
Yeah, the easiest way is through the Regenexx website. It's Regenexx with two X's .com. So Regenexx, two X's. And basically, the thing to do is to go there, look at what we do. If it looks interesting or it might be a good fit for your problem, then fill out a candidacy form. What we like to do is to get on the phone with patients. We'll review their imaging studies, their history, and, you know, tell you if you're a good fit or a poor candidate. We try to do that because a lot of patients travel to see us, so we want to make sure before they travel that they have some sense of where they fit. And that's pretty much it. We also have a blog there that's updated daily with interesting topics in this area, or, for instance, patient cases. I mean, one of the things we've seen a lot of is many patients want to hear about a patient just like them.
Mm-hmm.
And so we try to update that as often as we can. So there are literally, I don't know how many cases are on there, 100, 150 different cases.
And so if you have a knee problem, you can see several testimonials of knee patients that have had the stem cell procedure.
Right, or even get more specific. If you have a patellofemoral knee problem or if you failed microfracture, you can type in failed microfracture and probably three cases will come up of someone else who failed microfracture. So it's a good resource for patients. And obviously, if you don't see anyone like what you have, then that's also an important thing to discuss with the clinic physicians to make sure that this is a good fit.
Right, right. Well, this has been great. Thank you very much for your time today. I know you're very busy.
I really appreciate, Anne, you having me on, and look forward to answering any other questions you have in the future.
I can't wait. I've been loving watching this whole process since 2005 when it started. I'm very excited about the future. I think it looks bright. You've been listening to Your Health. I'm Anne Goldin. I've been with Dr. Chris Centeno. He is an expert and specialist in regenerative medicine. And you can find him at Regenexx.com.